It is indeed. From Manila in the Philippines, a land of 7,107 islands, we're now going to have to make a switch that's just about impossible. And that's from JC to Howard Bloom. Hi. I don't know how we're going to do that, but we'll give it the good old college try here. Howard Bloom is founder of the International Paleopsychology Project and the Big Bang Tango Media Lab, and in addition, is a founding board member of the Epic of Evolution Society. That's an interesting name. And the Darwin Project. He's also a member of the New York Academy of Sciences, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, the American Psychological Society, the Academy of Political Science, Human Behavior and Evolution Society, and the International Society for Human Ethology. Yikes. That's a lot. Now, we're going to talk with Howard about NASA. He's got a lot to say about NASA. And that's a bit of a different topic for him. But before we do that, I mean, obviously, with the world news the way it is, the war in the Middle East escalating like crazy, minute by minute, I'm not going to be able to afford not to ask him some questions in that area first. So in a moment, Howard Bloom. Now, again, we've got Howard Bloom scheduled. In fact, he's here right now. And normally, we've spent many hours talking about terrorism with Howard, but gee whiz. And we are going to talk about NASA. But Howard, welcome to the program. With what's going on, Howard, in the Middle East, it's absolutely unavoidable. I just can't not ask you about it. I spent, about an hour and a half watching Fox News. God bless the cable company here. They carry Fox News before I came on the air, and it looks absolutely awful. I want to get your take on the Middle East, and is this just sort of a big flurry of activity prior to some kind of actual peace, or is that could it be, as Newt Gingrich suggested, the opening flurry of World War III?
It is more likely to be the opening flurry of World War III than it is to be the opening of any kind of peace. There is no opening anywhere in this for any kind of peace right now. And if you want a connection, and there is a connection between what I've been doing with the space community and what's going on in the Middle East. The Middle East has been preoccupying me tremendously. It makes me incredibly stress-filled.
NASA will hold for just a little while. I really want your take on what's going on.
Rockets. Basically, you've got a proxy war between Iran and the West.
Right.
Israel is doing the West's dirty work. The Iranians founded Hezbollah in 1982. They founded it only 3 years after establishing the Iranian Revolutionary Constitution. The Iranian Revolutionary Constitution says that Islam is dominant over all other religions, and that basically Islam must rule the earth. And it's taken quite a while for Iran to get to the position where it now has mid-range ballistic missiles with a 1,200-mile range, where it now, in all probability, has nuclear warheads. And if it doesn't have them now, the figure we're being given of 10 years, Art, I cannot believe that figure for a minute. If it's 10 months, it wouldn't surprise me.
And if they it wouldn't now, surprise me either.
The Islamic bomb was first tested in 1998. That's almost 10 years ago. That's 8 years ago. And we know that Pakistan is a Sunni country and that Iran is a Shiite country. But the divisions between Shiites and Sunnis are not so big that the two cannot cooperate. It is very difficult to believe that Iran is operating without nuclear weapons at this point.
So Hezbollah has an obvious presence in the government of Lebanon, or at least they did until most of them were taken back down into Israel.
Right.
Is there a similar presence in Iran in the official government?
You mean a similar presence of Lebanon in Iran? Basically, this is an Iranian-owned and operated operation, Hezbollah.
Right.
There was a debate when Iran was putting its revolutionary constitution together, and one group of secularists said, it is important that we say, now that we have gained our freedom, that we support the rights of other nations to their freedom as well. But the clerics were the guys who really had the power, and they said, absolutely not. This is, we have a religion that calls for a one-world government, one world under one God, ruled by one law. And as a consequence, it's absolutely incumbent on us to bring Islam to the entire world. Now, in the case of Hezbollah, Hezbollah has claims, its head claims to have over 12,000 rockets. That's as of approximately 10 days ago. The reason that Israel was forced to cut off all the roads and clover leaves, originally I was horrified by that. Why do you destroy a country's infrastructure, for God's sakes? Why do you impoverish a people that way?
And probably because they were used to transport the rockets you're talking about.
Exactly. And tonight there was a report, and it was only an hour ago, that there is a rat line bringing in missiles from Syria anyway. You know that there are extensive bunkers and tunnels underneath Lebanon that Hezbollah has now had from 1982 until today to dig itself in, and to dig itself in with one purpose and one purpose only, to annihilate Israel. But here's the deal, Art. You know that I've spent 30 years or so researching Islam, and over the last year I've learned how to read the motherlode. That is, I've learned how to read the hadith and relate them back to the Quran. The hadith are the eyewitness accounts of Muhammad's life. And they are holy books, just like the Quran is a holy book. And basically, the pattern of Islam from the very beginning, from Muhammad's day, remember, Muhammad led 65 military campaigns. He commanded 65 military campaigns. He personally led 27 of them. And in the words of the Islamic scholars, he left a total system that included a military system with military strategy. And his strategy was, when he couldn't get a big win, he went after the Jews. He went after the Jews who lived in Medina, the town where he was camped out. He went after one tribe, drove them out of the city, an ethnic cleansing, took all of their goods. This made him a big man in town because he was able to hand out all the riches of the Jews to all those who would follow him. And it allowed him to bring in other tribes as potential allies. The next time he wasn't able to win a battle and it wasn't able to bring in a lot of money, that is a lot of clothing, a lot of the things that were valuable at the time, a lot of sheep, a lot of date orchards, he once again went and clobbered another group of Jews. He did this four times. So clobbering the Jews in Islamic military tradition is a prelude. It's a prelude to bigger conquests. Each time he clobbered a Jewish tribe, it was to set himself up for a bigger battle against a much, much bigger enemy. Now, who are the bigger enemies these days? Once you get rid of this little tiny country the size of a fly speck on the global map,
I'm not sure that I'd characterize it that way. It is small geographically, but whatever we do or don't know about an Islamic bomb,
right?
We do know that the Israelis have lots of them buried in the desert.
Yes, absolutely true.
So a question to you would be,
they've been making nuclear stuff for a long time.
That's right. So my question to you would be, the Islamic bomb, aside for a moment, how far will Israel be pushed before they dredge one of these up and use it?
You know, Art, that's a very good question. And I think that Israel would have to be extraordinarily desperate to go to those lengths. I think that Israel would have to feel that it was on the verge of utter annihilation. And even then, knowing the nature, look, I'm Jewish and an atheist. We both know that. But knowing the nature of us Jews, we'd have a lot of moral qualms about using them, even if we were on the verge of extinction.
Explain how you're Jewish and an atheist. In other words, as a Jew, perhaps not Christ, but, God still fits in there somewhere, or did, or should.
Well, you know, this is a tricky one that we've danced around a number of times. I'm Jewish, and I have Jewish parents, and they had Jewish parents, and their parents were Jewish, grandparents were Jewish, all the way going back to God knows. I mean, when you're Jewish, you're born as either a Levi or a Cohen. You're traditionally a part of a tribe that goes back 2,800 years. The Levis are the Cohens. My family is of the Levis. So if my family traces its roots back accurately, then originally my family was living someplace in the Middle East. There are people who say that's not true. There are people who say that there was a large tribe of Jews living in basically Turkish territory, who converted to Judaism, and that many of us Jews come from that tribe. But one way or the other, as a human being, you know, the size of my nose, the shape of my face, and various other things, I'm Jewish.
Okay, well, be that as it may, what about the belief in God, part?
What about the belief in God part?
Or the lack of it in your case?
That, I can't help that any more than another person can help his or her belief. Mm-hmm. At the age of 13, it suddenly hit me that I was an atheist. And Lord knows, Art, we'd really have to go digging to find out where that came from. But it was so deep in my bones, it was so deep in my marrow, that there's no way I can evade it or avoid it.
So you honestly believe there is no higher power, there is no creator, as it were. We're down here on our own.
Yes, and I think there's an old rabbinic saying from the 15th century, and it says, in essence, God left creation half finished so that we would finish the other part. And if that and if that's the notion of God, then so be it. I think that it's up to you and me to make peace. It's up to you and me to make justice. It's up to you and me to make the kinds of multi-generational projects that take humans out of misery and put them in a far better position than they ever were before. And it's up to you and me to do the kinds of projects that were done for you and me. I'm sure we both came from families that at one point were poor. And those families eventually managed to crawl up to the middle class. They didn't do it by themselves. They did it with the efforts of hundreds and thousands of other people who came before them, who invented everything from language to tools to the kind of industrial machinery that allows us to have inexpensive cotton shirts.
Okay, well, no, for the record, we both did not come from poor families. In my case, Howard, my family was pretty well off. However, at a very early age, I chose to leave home.
Right.
My family chose not to assist me for reasons that I now understand, and I had to crawl out of absolute personal poverty for many, many, many years as a radio guy. So I sort of crawled out on my own from that. But for the record, my family was reasonably well off. We certainly weren't rich. We were fairly well off. Now, I would like to know, Newt did say the opening salvos of World War III or something just like that, and you just agreed with him. How do you see this current conflict from where it is right now developing into what could be World War III?
Well, China has invested a tremendous amount of money in Iran, and a lot of that money is invested in developing oil fields in Iran. Those oil fields will only be available if the Iranian government holds firm. Russia has got, for some reason, a great emotional affinity for Iran, probably because it can use Iran to play it against us. So the major challenge over the last two or three weeks for Condoleezza Rice has been to go to the Chinese, to go to the Russians, and to keep them from falling in line with Iran as Iran plays out its hand. We don't know what hand Iran is playing. And you and I don't know if you and I have discussed the Guardian in Britain's Iranian hypothesis about how we got into the Iraq war to begin with.
Well, we should. I think you were last on July 17th with George, so that may be one I missed.
Right. Well, basically it goes something like this. Once upon a time, we, who were manipulating Saddam Hussein at the time, we'd helped him get into power. When Iran really hated our guts and made that very apparent, we decided to get even. And we encouraged Saddam Hussein to go to war against Iran. Now, Iran welcomed that war because Iran, as I said, felt that its revolution would sweep the entire Islamic world, and then, having swept the entire Islamic world, would sweep onwards past the Islamic world to you and me. And one obvious step was to take the neighbor next door, Iraq, especially since Iraq and Iran's clergy are intermixed.
Right.
Totally intermixed. They spent 8 years trying to toss Saddam out of power and put a revolutionary government like their own in charge. And they failed. It cost them a million lives and God knows how many millions of dollars. And they failed. And then they came up with a clever scheme, according to The Guardian. The scheme went like this. There was a man named Ahmad Chalabi. And Ahmad Chalabi had spent 25 years working his way up in contacts in Washington. He had worked his way up in the level of his contacts in Congress, the Senate, in the Pentagon, and in the White House. And the Iranian intelligence agency phonied up a bunch of documents showing exactly where all of the weapons of mass destruction were and exactly what their nature was.
Mm-hmm.
It, diagrams, charts, the whole thing. Everything that you
need. Well, I'll tell you, when we found out, we sure dropped Chalabi like a hot rock.
Well, what did we do? We dropped him in a way that was so peculiar and so mysterious that it hasn't been explained to this day. All of a sudden, we raided his home one day. We never gave an adequate reason why. He was our golden boy who would take over Iraq for us, as far as we were concerned. And suddenly, he was humiliated, and we never got an explanation. The only explanation we got was something vague about Chalabi having something to do with Iranian intelligence.
Mm. Yeah, well, actually, you're right. So Iran cooked all of this up. Iran virtually launched us into the war against Iraq. I think that's fair, right?
Right. And now what does that do to us? It does something that Osama bin Laden characterized very cannily in one of his speeches. He said, look, we bled the elephant to death by poking it under its belly in the case of the Soviet Union. And we're doing it again in the case of the Americans. And what did Osama bring forth? He trotted out all of the statistics on our gross domestic debt, the whole thing, all of our economic bleeding, hemorrhaging, the kind of statistics that you read in the Wall Street Journal. Now, he took personal credit for that. But in fact, Iran was aiding that. If it's true that we went to war in Iraq, it's very hard to believe that George Bush Jr. would have such a small mind that he would go to war with Iraq only because there's a picture of his dad on the floor of a hotel, and everyone who enters that hotel has to walk on it.
Yeah.
To commit 150,000 troops or more, 165,000 in some cases, to war just because of that, I'm sorry, even for George Bush Jr., that doesn't make sense.
No, I don't buy it either.
But if, indeed, he and Tony Blair have what Tony Blair swore in front of Parliament over and over again he had, which is the precise documents explaining how these weapons could be mobilized in 48 hours or less, Tony Blair does not impress me as being a dishonest person. Not by a long shot. And if Tony Blair is going before Parliament and telling them that he's got documents. Where did he get them? Well, The Guardian was being somewhat speculative, but about 2 weeks ago on the Colbert Report, Colbert had an author on who had left the CIA and had been forced to write up his what he knew about the CIA in the form of a novel. That's the only way he could get it past the CIA's surveillance process, their censorship process. It was all about Iran. It was all about the mysterious role of the dark hand of Iran in all of this. Now, in the last couple of weeks, what we've seen is that Iran has taken two of its client groups, one of which is wholly owned. It's as wholly owned by Iran as your local McDonald's is by both its owner and the franchisee. It's a franchise, except it is wholly owned. Often your local McDonald's is owned by a local guy. I'm sorry, this group is not locally owned in Lebanon. This group, Hezbollah, told us very bluntly in the 1980s, do not, and these are the words from a Hezbollah cleric in the 1980s, do not believe for a minute that Hezbollah wants a revolutionary Islamic state only in Lebanon. We want an Islamic revolutionary state that rules the world. Well, now they're showing that they have worked with a long-range plan of some sort, and they have managed to sucker us. Look how much money we have spent.
Okay, I agree with you, Howard. They've suckered us into the Iraq War. I think you've made that point crystal clear. But from this point forward, even with the Katyushas falling like rain on Israel, I still don't quite understand, even conceding that you're correct and that's how they got us into the war, how this will develop into World War III.
Well, I do not think that it will develop into World War III as of today, because I believe that Condoleezza Rice and whoever else is involved behind the scenes in diplomacy has done a good job of pulling China and Russia along with us. But if the kind of situation developed that we had in World War I, where a minor crackpot, a Serbian nationalist, kills a person who's never had any governmental power whatsoever,
That would do it. All right, listen, Howard, hold on. We're at the bottom of the hour, so hold tight for a moment. From Manila in the Philippines, a land of 7,107 islands, I'm Art Bell, and this is Coast to Coast AM. Here we have some people who have decided that we will either convert to their religion or we will die, from their point of view. And frequently I wonder how many people this really means. How widespread is this belief, this movement, this Islamic fundamentalist belief? How really widespread is it? One of the things that we really don't get in the West, not that I'm in the West anymore, come to think of it, but one thing we don't get in the West, or for that matter, in this part of Southeast Asia, in my opinion, is the true depth of that conviction. We'll ask Howard about that in a moment. One of the things that I think it's very important that the American people, people in the West, and for that matter, this part of Southeast Asia, understand is how really widespread this Islamic fundamentalist movement is, the one that believes that we ought to either convert or die. And at this point, I think they've given up on conversion and they're hotter on the dying part. Howard, how widespread, worldwide, is this movement truly?
Well, you know, because you're in the Philippines right now.
That's right.
And you know that Mindanao is controlled by who?
Well, that's going a little far. The southern
part. Well, not really, and I'll tell you why.
The southern part.
Within 100 years of Muhammad's death, Islam had an empire that went all the way from Spain to the Philippines. That is a huge distance.
Yes,
that's
indeed.
More than halfway around the world, especially in such a primitive time, around 800 or 700 A.D.
That's right.
That empire was five times the size of the Roman Empire. In other words, it's the biggest empire in the history of this planet. It's seven times the size of the United States of America. And the remarkable thing is this. A couple of days ago on Charlie Rose, there was a Harvard historian who said point blank, that no empire in the history of the world has ever learned how to win the hearts and minds of people. Now, is that true of Islam? Remember that Aceh, which is not that far from where you are right now,
mm-hmm.
It's part of the Indonesian, Malaysian, Philippine
That's right.
vastness of islands. Aceh was taken within 30 to 40 years of Muhammad's death, and Spain was taken within about 60 to 70 years. Of Muhammad's death. Now, in Algeria, are people still Muslims?
My question is worldwide.
Right.
Worldwide, how really big is this fundamentalist belief?
It's very hard to tell because I used to estimate it at 5%. Now, Muslim demographers are claiming right now that there are 1.6 billion Muslims in the world, and that would mean 80 million Muslims, 5%. 80 million is a lot of people. That's
yes,
as many as the population of Germany and England during the days of the Second World War.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people. But one of my Islamic friends, when I said this, looked at me really strangely, as if I was wacko, and I thought I'd estimated the figure too high, that 5% was much too high. No, he said, when it comes to being sympathetic, when it comes to the people who had smiles of glee that they wouldn't let you see, in his community, which is right near mine, in Brooklyn, when it comes to the number of people who are sympathetic to the fundamentalists, he said, it's 70%. Now, that is very hard for me to believe.
Wow, that's a little difficult for me to believe, too.
Right, but...
You really think it's that high? It's somewhere between...
No, I think it's somewhere in between.
Yeah,
Look at your own situation right now. How many fundamentalist groups are there who show up in the news all the time in the Philippines?
Quite a few.
Right. I mean, there are groups that's been beheading tourists.
Yeah, but again, it's not teeming with fundamentalists. There are some radicals, no doubt about it, on
right.
Mindanao, in the southern part of Mindanao. But I wouldn't go as far as to say they run Mindanao.
No, they don't.
Really don't.
But the fact is that you've got fundamentalist groups in Mindanao and in the Philippines, in many of the other islands. You've
That's
got
true.
Fundamentalist extremists in Malaysia and Indonesia.
Yes.
To your south and to your west, if my sense of direction is correct.
Right.
You've got them in Central Asia. You've got them in the Xinjiang sector of China. You've got them all through Central Asia. You've got them all the way down through the Middle East. You've got them all the way across a third of Africa, because Islam had a third of Africa and was exploiting two-thirds of Africa up until roughly 1880, until 1880, Islam was using Africa as a source of ivory, gold, and slaves. Mm-hmm. We had a slave trade that was horrendous. It uprooted 10 million to 11 million people from their homes. It killed one out of every 10 of them in transport. That's a million people that were killed in our slave trade. That's horrendous.
I know.
No wonder it's called an African Holocaust. But the slave trade in East Africa and Asia and the Middle East, the trade in slaves from Africa, was 120 million lives uprooted and far more killed. Because, again, there is a military code to Islam. There is a military strategy to Islam. And the example Muhammad set is kill the men, take the women and children as slaves. That is your right under the Islamic or under the fundamentalist interpretation of Islam. There are many Muslims who would not accept that for a minute, who would not agree with that for a minute.
Right. Well, the key is how many. I'm really trying to figure that out because the size of our enemy is certainly relevant. Let me try this one out on you. Right now, Israel's pounding the hell out of southern Lebanon, actually
right, as of this minute.
Well above southern Lebanon. How successful, in your opinion, are they being in crippling? Obviously, they're not going to get rid of Hezbollah, but in crippling Hezbollah for a significant amount of time and setting up ultimately some kind of buffer zone.
If they can destroy the road system that feeds Hezbollah, if they can get Hezbollah to use up, or if they can destroy its 12,000 rockets, they can make it very difficult for Hezbollah to rearm itself. I mean, 12,000 is a lot. Imagine how many years it takes to build up that many rockets. They can also keep it from bringing in new rockets from Iran that are mid-range and long-range rockets.
All right, let's try this. Let's say that they're being at least moderately successful so far. If Iran looks at this, and if Iran really is running the show,
right,
then Iran might say to itself, well, look, this didn't work. Hezbollah just was not that successful. So if we're going to continue, we're going to have to become more directly involved.
Right. And if they can become more directly involved, all they have to do is take two missiles or three missiles. And if they have either nuclear warheads or if they're willing to use Syria's chemical warheads, because remember,
right.
Syria has all of the chemical weapons that we've talked about with horror over the last 10 years, and including VX gas, the most deadly of them all.
Yeah.
And all they have to do is take a couple of their long-range rockets and hit three cities, Jerusalem, Tel Aviv, and a city that's already being hit, Haifa. That's the
all
end
right.
of Israel.
Yeah, would that be the tripwire that would cause Israel to use a nuclear device?
That's a good question. You and I would have to hope that it was. And we would have to hope that it was because somebody's got to put Iran out of business before Iran puts all the rest of us out of business. Again, going back to the tradition, remember, in Islam, there's something very different about Islam from most other religions. In Islam, to be truthful, righteous, and upright, one must follow the example of Muhammad. One must follow the path of his life. Now, there are periods in Christianity where the same thing has been said about Christ. We must follow in his footsteps. But we have the footsteps here of a man who used murder on a regular basis. He murdered all of his critics. He murdered even two slave girls who satirized him. He had one run down by a war horse. But the most important thing is to capture Mecca, which was his major enemy. His major target was to capture Mecca. He went to a town called Khyber. Again, it was a Jewish town, and it was considered the Garden of the Hejaz, that is, the Garden of the Desert of the Arabian world. He took the city through ceaseless siege. He beheaded every single one of its men. He took the women and children as slaves, and he did it with a very specific purpose in mind. He wanted to show the people in Mecca, if you don't succumb to me peacefully, this is what will happen to you. And it worked. And that is what Iran apparently may be trying to do with Israel.
So if they see Hezbollah again failing, are they going to step back and go to Plan B, or are they going to become, in your opinion, directly involved?
I would hope that they would step back and go to Plan B, because they have several things that we are not right now taking into account. First of all, they've got 165,000 American hostages. They are in the slow, patient process of taking over Iraq. Remember, Saddam Hussein was able to eliminate every sort of organizational force that existed in his country that might in any way threaten him.
Quite
Everyone
true.
Except
he
one.
Mm-hmm.
And that one was the network of mosques. And that network of mosques is run to this very day by an Iranian, al-Sistani. So the only political party that was left in a land that we had cleared for democracy was the Iranian Revolutionary Party.
Mm-hmm.
But Iran knows that we think short term. We think in terms of exit strategies. We think in terms of quarterly profits.
Mm-hmm.
And the word patience shows up so many times in the Quran that you wouldn't believe it. Because the comprehension in Islam of the importance of multi-generational projects, long, slow, patient projects, is immense. And our comprehension of the importance of these long-term, slow projects has almost disappeared. And that is
well, I absolutely agree with all of that, Howard. So you're suggesting then that if Hezbollah fails or is sufficiently pushed back, that Iran probably will just sort of fade back a little bit and try and figure out a new patient way to get done what they want done.
I'm sure that they already have it in mind. Now, they own, have we ever discussed what sunburn missiles are?
No.
Well, they own a bunch of sunburn missiles. Sunburn missiles are Soviet missiles that move at 2.2 times the speed of sound. That's
mm-hmm.
very, very fast.
Yes, it is.
They're cruise missiles. They are very intelligent cruise missiles. They're made for skimming over the surface of water, and they will literally skim down into the troughs of the waves and skim over the peaks of the waves. And
right.
they'll do it in a zigzag pattern.
Right.
They carry a warhead six times the size of the Hiroshima bomb in power. And they are built for a very specific purpose. America has a force projection capability that depends on between 12 and 24 aircraft carriers. Without those, we are dead in the water. And these
so you're aircraft... suggesting they could take our aircraft carriers out at
will? Oh, yes. Oh, yes. In other words, if we were to do a show of force, which we usually do with our aircraft carriers, basically saying, we're the big boys on the block. They have a way of demonstrating that we're not, crippling us at the knees. Then they have our 165,000 troops that are hostage as well.
Let me circle back a little bit. You said
okay.
six times the power of the Hiroshima
bomb.
Right. I don't know how you get that unless it's nuclear.
It is nuclear. Now, this is assuming, I mean, they've bought these missiles that, and they've had them for quite a while. That are designed specifically for nuclear warheads. There's no
well,
point.
Okay, I'll buy that. But I mean, how do you prove to us that they actually have the warheads to go along?
I can't. Your enemy. Now, going back to the lessons of Muhammad. Muhammad says war is guile. By that he means war is lies and trickery. War is misleading the perception of your enemy. It's
sure.
keeping your enemy guessing.
Sure.
And in the same, we did that with D-Day. We very successfully kept the Germans from knowing that we were massing a huge number of troops. in the north of England. It wasn't easy, but we did it. It's much easier in a totalitarian country like Iran mask what you've got. And one of the things that they've been trying to do in Iran is play with us so that we wouldn't know how big or how small their force is. I suspect it's much, much bigger than we think. I suspect that's why they're taking this chance now.
Right, but you also don't think they're really going to use it. You think they're going to sort of back away and work on this from a different angle.
I really think that their goal is to accomplish what Muhammad accomplished with the destruction of Khaybar and then the taking of Mecca. It is said in the Hadith, and this may sound ridiculous, but this is the Hadith. First of all, God took the world, says Muhammad, and unrolled it to me like a scroll. And he brought its far ends together on either side, and he promised me all of this. That's one of the passages in the Hadith, and that shows up about six times in the Hadith. There's another one that says, God promised me Constantinople and Rome. And it took 700 years of patient work for Islam to finally take Constantinople. It took it in 1453, 700 years after Muhammad's death. It never gave up on the project. It worked steadily on the project for 700 years. And eventually God rewarded Islam for its patience. Next comes Rome. That means Europe. That means Europe. And why is Oriana Fallaci living in New York City, not Italy? Because Italy is too cowardly to allow her to live there after she said some nasty but true things about the Muslims. The French also are kowtowing to Islam in many, many ways. Thank God for the headscarf thing, at least.
Yeah, well, I'm not surprised at anything the French do. You mentioned earlier that Condi Rice is apparently being quite successful in her talks with China.
So far
and Russia. If we were privy right now to some of the diplomacy going on between the United States, Russia, and China about what's happening in the Middle East right now, what kind of talk would we be hearing?
You know, that's beyond my comprehension. I don't know what kind of deals they are making. I don't know what they're using. I mean, for one thing, there's an argument that you or I would use if we were in Condoleezza Rice's position. Iran having a nuclear capability with missiles that are right now have a 1,200-mile range and will very shortly have an 1,800-mile range. Do you know who that brings right into their target zone? Russia and China, much more rapidly than it brings in Western Europe. And that is something that I would bring up at length with the Russians and the Chinese.
Good point.
And I would remind the Chinese that every time they have gone according to the theory of any enemy of my enemy is my friend,
right,
the enemy that they have supported, the enemy of their enemy, has turned around after it defeated its enemy and has defeated China, has walked right into the capital of China and taken over. It's happened over and over again in Chinese history. So I would remind them of that. I would also remind the Russians that that had happened, and that that could happen again. Because Russia and China have more to lose here than we do, even though they don't perceive it that way because they're in the oil game and because they're both trying to break what they call American hegemony, the American mastery of the world, as they perceive it.
Well, that's quite a tall order. I mean, how do you do that, keeping the world still even slightly intact? I'm not sure how you do that.
Well, in our case, I think that the people in the Bush administration are probably doing a very good job of their diplomacy. The fact that they have some sort of an agreement on the table, and they seem to have gotten unanimity for it, although it's hard to tell, is a positive sign, even though the Lebanese won't go along with it at all, and we really need to give the Israelis at least another 6 weeks to wipe out this rat's nest.
And that's how long you think it might go on. It does show signs of continuing, and this peace initiative, I just don't think anybody's going to pay any attention to
it
until they're ready.
Remember the phrase, peace for land?
Yes.
We were sold that phrase for 10 or 15 years. And when Israel gave up land, did it get peace?
No, and frankly, they didn't really expect it.
They didn't really expect it, but the fact is that every time the international community has guaranteed any form of peace to Israel, it has failed to materialize.
That's absolutely correct. All right, hold tight, Howard. We're at the top of yet another hour. You really came on to talk a little bit about NASA, but I simply could not, obviously, resist asking him about all of this. With all of this going on in the Middle East, we all have to keep our heads down. I'm going to hope that he's right and that Condi Rice has been telling the Chinese and the Russians that they, as he pointed out, have a lot to lose. So while we don't know exactly what's being said, I think on Howard's part, that was a pretty damn good guess. From the Philippines, Manila in the Philippines, I'm Art Bell.